Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU Libraries, and I'd like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. I must say I'm a little embarrassed with my introduction that I'm going to be providing you. I left it to the last minute and then got caught in homecoming traffic, so I'm really going to be winging it, I'm afraid. When I conceptualized the idea of the Michigan Writers Series, one of the individuals that was right up at the very top of my list of the kind of person that I wanted to invite down here to Michigan State University and to read to the community and to discuss writing with the community was Michael Delp. So I'm thrilled and honored that he is here this evening, and I'm so delighted that all of you have made it through the traffic and are here, and I think we're in for a really wonderful evening. Mr. Delp is truly a Michigan writer in all ways. He was born in Greenville, Michigan. He went to school at Alma College. He now is director of creative writing at Interlochen Arts Academy. He is a fisherman. He has a wife. He has a daughter. He is a co-editor of New Poems from the Third Coast, Contemporary Michigan Poetry, first published in 1988 by Wayne State University Press, and now this year another edition is coming out. Mr. Delp's own poetry has been published in Southern Poetry Review, Poetry Northwest, and The River Watch, to name just a few. He has also published several full-length poetry collections, Over the Grave of Horses, The Text of the River, Under the Influence of Waters, and The Coast of Nowhere, Meditations on Rivers, Lakes, and Streams. His fiction and nonfiction have appeared in Gray's Sporting Journal and Detroit Magazine, among others. On Delp's first full-length poetry collection, fellow writer and Michigander, Jim Harrison commented, "In Over the Grave of Horses, Michael Delp mines an area owned by Rilke and Lorca. This is a wonderful collection of poems for those who are curious about a state of mind that comes even before poetry." Will you please join me in welcoming Michael Delp?
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Very kind. I've been driving 85 miles an hour to get down here, so I'm really, and I'm as far as you can get from an urban person. And I know to you guys this isn't urban, but to me it's the other end of the world. And I don't get down here very often, so I'm really, really disoriented, and I apologize for that. And the other reason I'm really disoriented is I have an old friend, John Beck, here, and two high school friends came tonight, and I haven't seen them in eons. And I brought, am I too loud?
No.
I got to double check this because I just read this the other day. I wasn't going to read this, but I think because my two Greenville, my old Greenville girlfriends are here, I'm gonna read this. I don't know what this is. It's kind of a combination of fiction and nonfiction. And I'm confused now because I've read it several times, and these two probably know the truth. So it's a little bit dangerous to read this to them. And there are some people mentioned in here that they know. But I'll start. It's about 15 minutes long, and then I'll finish up with some poems. Just to set the scene, it's the narrator of this piece is an aging 50-year-old guy who was once a surfer. And when I was in high school, my best friend went to California. He was a year ahead of me, and he came back with a surfboard. And I bought a surfboard from another guy that went with him for $25 or $20. And we used to surf Lake Michigan in storms. We'd wait for a squall, and we'd drive over there with our boards. And that's where some of this story comes from. Some of it's fiction, some of it's true. So I don't know what it is. There's a lot of Beach Boys references in here. I'm 51 years old. I still listen to the Beach Boys. Screaming at the top of my lungs in the car. So this is called A Bushy, Bushy Blonde Hairdo. Maybe bushy, bushy white, but... I never rode the big sets outside Waimea Bay, the waves rising like walls of canyons, each breaker an avalanche of foam and sound. I never took the chance to drift up and down the California coast looking for good surf or had any idea what it felt like to shoot the curl inside a breaker on the Banzai pipeline. I never caught a wave on the north shore of Oahu in November, pumped up for the winter surfing season, because I grew up in a farm town in the middle of Michigan. And before I was 16, the closest I got to waves was the wind undulating across Keith King's cornfield when I was hunting pheasants. I'd flush a big hen up into the sky, but before I could bring the gun to my shoulder, my eyes would always catch on the way the wind moved over the top of the stalks, the way everything blew, and how the shocks sounded when they rustled against each other. Then the wind rolling away, rising and falling over the tops of the corn like wave after wave. I'd hunch down at just about eye level to the tassels and let the wind wash over me. I wanted desperately to head west, hit the beaches at Huntington, Rincon, maybe head down to Baja, surfing the mile markers, hoping to find good waves at a place called Shipwrecks, and then dropping down into the Gulf of California on the inland side of the peninsula. I wanted my feet on a board, my back tanned, and my hair perfectly blonde, a bushy, bushy blonde hairdo, made even bushier and more blonde by the salt spray and the sun. I never came close. I watched The Endless Summer 6 times at the Silver Theater before it left town for lack of ticket sales, making sure that one of those times I had my dad's 8mm Kodak hidden under my parka. The copy I'd made was dark and grainy, and you could barely hear any sound, but could see those 2 kids looking all over the world for perfect surf, following summer everywhere. But my summers were different. Unloading boxcars of dry milk for a guy who owned a dairy and an ice cream factory. 50-pound bags stacked 30 high, 40 deep, 1 kid to a car, and the whole day to kill yourself. At night, I'd hop on my Schwinn Corvette and take the high street hill route so that I could feel the wind in my face, then ride around Baldwin Lake for a quick swim, hoping for a ski boat to come close enough to shore to send even the smallest wake my way. My friends and I listened to the Beach Boys, cranking up the volume on my dad's Magnavox, using the car engine intro to 409 to shake the house and drive my sister crazy. She preferred Del Shannon or the Platters, but it was surf music all the time for us. Jan and Dean, 2 girls for every boy in Surf City, or the Marquettes helping us through the surfer stomp. We'd hop around the room and make ourselves look like we were surfing, holding our hands out from our sides, or dancing out to the end of the board to hang 10, do a curl, then dip down into the pipeline for a long shot out of the living room. Some nights it was the Ventures or the Waikikis and Wipeout bouncing off the walls, my dad's Vivaldi LPs shaking in their jackets. But it was always surfing music and always loud, an ocean of sound rolling through the neighborhood. I was landlocked until I was 16, and Ray Povolo reluctantly signed off in my driver's ed class, shaking his finger at my heavy foot, the desire to always be in the passing lane. Once in a while, we'd drive to Lake Michigan during thunderstorms and body surf off the coast of the Muskegon State Park, the beach littered with alewives and empty beer bottles. We'd bring a record player, one of those little battery-operated jobs that only played 45s, and then sit on the sand and watch the surf, waiting for what we thought was a set, something rideable. There on the beach, it was always the Ventures, or once in a while, Sandy Nelson playing Let There Be Drums. When I was 17, Dave Ford came back from his senior trip to California, his new long blonde hair making him look like Brian Wilson. He had a battered up Hobie tied to his van with clothesline. I offered him $20 at his garage sale, and he took it, just like that, saying he needed the pizza money for college. The rest, as they say, is history. I tied that board to the top of my dad's 67 Jeep, a red leftover from some local fire department, and drove around town all summer, the Beach Boys blasting from the one speaker I had tied to the windshield frame. We hung our feet out over the doors, the entire cockpit open to the wind. We tooled. We cruised, we looked cool, and combed our hair with peroxide, and then messed it up right away to make it look windblown, California style. We stopped for burgers and fries, malts at the High Delight, where the waitresses skated out to take our orders. There, under the neon lights, we'd eat as slowly as possible, waiting for the other kids to cruise past, all of them gaping at a surfboard so far from home. We surfed whenever we could, hit the beach in Muskegon during storms, heavy squalls, even went to Sleeping Bear Point in November once and surfed in the kind of storm that took the Edmund Fitzgerald down. We had wetsuits by then, and Mark Christensen and I both had Live the Life You Love hand lettered across our backs. We thought we were surf bums, but we were really farm boys, teenagers in limbo between Korea and Vietnam, swooning at every line to Don't Worry, Baby. Once on a whim, we put contact paper that looked like wood all over the side of the Jeep, a Woody for sure, then parked it at the... I'm glad you guys are laughing, because sometimes it's pretty lonely. Then parked it at the Baldwin Lake Beach every day for a week and just kind of hung around it, leaning on the fenders, the lake flat and calm, 100 degrees in July, no surf anywhere for 100 miles. When we saw Harley Marquardt drift past with his fifth-wheel camper, we both looked at each other like an anvil had fallen on us from out of the sky. If you could hook up a trailer to such a thing, then you could rig up a surfboard. We welded a frame together and mounted it on a plate that had what Christensen called both pitch and yaw capabilities, and then bolted some ski boots onto a mock-up board we'd managed to hack out of fiberglass resin and chunks of old styrofoam from the refrigerator plant where my dad worked. We'd whittled it down to roughly the shape of the Hobie, but from a distance it looked like some kind of deep sea fish, a marlin maybe, scuttled in mid-Michigan, run aground on the back of a Ford pickup with a bunch of loony kids driving it around as if they were part of a traveling carnival advertising a Gulf of Mexico freak show. The entire contraption hung out over the side of the truck, cantilevered, Christensen said. Land surfing is what we called it. Christensen would ride, and I'd be out there 3 feet off the side of his pickup, screaming down back roads at 60 miles an hour. When you tip back, the board would lift up into the air, then drop back down like you were riding a wave or the back of a dolphin. I could hear the music screaming from his speakers, my feet laced into an old pair of Castley ski boots, my arms flailing the air like I was rocketing down the face of a monster at Doheny. I remember feeling like I was part of the wind, that if I closed my eyes and crouched down, pretended like I was about to be washed out, I could open my eyes and I'd be landing on a beach at the other end of the world where someone like Annette Funicello would be squirming in her two-piece to get her hands on me. Night surfing was best. We'd head out into Keith King's cornfield following the narrow access roads, the truck in the ruts, the board hanging out over the corn, the shocks and ears flying, imagining the sound of the tassels hitting the board to be the echo of heavy surf off Maui. We stopped night surfing the only time I drove, and Christensen hit a cow. I punched him up to just a little over 60. I had shutdown coming from a guitar amp we had hooked up in the pickup bed, and Christensen was making the board buck like a horse, up and down, and then he ran into one of Keith King's Holsteins. 45 stitches, a broken jaw, flipped right out of the boots and skidded 10 feet into a ditch. He was unconscious for 2 days. When I visited him for the first time, I gave him the Hobie t-shirt the Beach Boys had signed when I joined their fan club. He wadded it up and threw it in the corner and said he never wanted to hear another stupid-ass surfing song as long as he lived. We started parting our friendship then. He strayed toward the Beatles, then the Stones, and finally ended up dropping acid one night, listening to Jimi Hendrix, his life a growing montage of psychedelic colors and American flags mixed with the pain of a hip that never healed right. I drove around town by myself for a few months, listening to the slow ones like Surfer Girl and In My Room. I was lost 10 states away, hopelessly looking into California every night that was taped next to my bed. My dreams grew ever specific, girls and beaches. This is where I gotta be careful. Girls and beaches, then specific girls like Ginger Gibson on specific beaches, like Redondo and me riding the wild surf. In my fantasies, they were all there, Carl and Dennis, Mike Love and Al Jardine. I played them into a fantasy soundtrack for my life, sure that every move I made was punctuated by their intricate harmonies or the driving sound of a couple of guitars and a set of drums. I kept my frayed cutoffs and hirachi sandals, let my hair stay long for a while. Part of me stayed in the cornfield that night, young and foolish, ready to do just about anything for a cheap thrill, my hair wild and the ocean in my head, while another part of me lurched toward a life on dry land. Christensen trucked off to MSU, and my dad sold the Jeep to buy a four-door Corvair, a family car that looked like a rolling meat case. Now I'm 30 years from that night, 3 decades from surfing cornfields in the ice waves of Sleeping Bear in November, miles from being 18, miles from Nancy Dolan, the only girl I loved in all of high school, all of middle school, the one single girl who melted under the pressure of my hands, and the first one who let me get closer than either of us thought possible while we listened to Surfer Girl slow dancing in her basement. What happened last week came as a revelation, like a bolt of light. I took the old Hobie down out of the garage and set it out in the yard, sprayed it with a hose a few times, then waxed it down with some old candle stubs, just like I used to, orange and blue in the last light. I took my tape deck out into the garage and drank a six-pack, listening again and again to the Beach Boys tell me what I wanted to hear, that the sloop John B. was still sailing, that Mike Love Stingray had beaten the Superstock Dart for the 10,000th time. I wanted to hear Caroline Know until my ears bled and do it again until my legs wilted from doing the frog all around the garage. I went down inside to that place where the Beach Boys live, where every car worth driving is chopped and channeled, its headlights Frenched, where cheerleaders dance within inches of my face when I remember sitting on the bench, the Yellow Jackets blown out again in another rout. A place where time herself sits on the hoods of GTOs and Z28s and Chevy Supersports with 396s so frightening they could rip the tires right off the rims. I wanted Nancy Dolan to come up into the light, her face flushed and perfect, and tell me one more time that she loved the way Al Jardine could crawl up into her spine and turn her liquid in my arms. I woke my wife and told her to call me in sick, then loaded up the Woody with my board inside and headed out singing my song, really dumping the board into my 88 Blazer and heading out with a thermos of coffee. I felt that tinge of pain when you realize that time is right next to you in the passing lane and you're already redlined, the pistons almost molten, no honor in downshifting and swerving off to go home. 20 minutes north to Sleeping Bear, 48 years old and almost 50 pounds over my high school graduation weight, a full wetsuit, looking more like a rubberized egg than a surfer. I pulled into Platte Bay at 5 a.m. Early spring snow was still on the ground. 6 steelhead fishermen gawked and howled when I walked past their fire, the bright orange of the Hobie just beginning to reflect the first light of morning. I slipped into the big lake through a band of shard ice, then dipped my hands and paddled out. Wind, rain, sleet. I could see waves breaking just off the sandbar where the week before I'd landed 2 huge steelhead. I could still hear my wife begging me to stay home and the dog howling in the yard when I pulled out. But I was here to surf, I told myself, not feel guilty. I took the first wave that came by, I imagined maybe 5 or 6 feet, and felt myself lift off like I was riding some kind of wing. I rode for a mile, I thought, rode and pumped my legs, imagined that I walked to the end of the board, hung 10, then dropped perfectly across the face of the wave and shot the breaking foam for the beach. Instead, I went rigid. My body aimed for the beach and did a sailor dive off the front of the board. When I came to, I was sitting next to 6 guys and waiters. I could feel their fire slowly opening up parts of my face. There was wet sand in my teeth. The board was propped up in front of me to break the wind, part of it anyway. "Where's my board?" I said. "Gone," one of them said. "Gone out into the lake on the current of the river, probably halfway to Milwaukee by now." "You're a fool," one of them said. "A dumbass fool for coming out here in this stuff." I could feel my head bleeding and one eye refused to focus. "What in the living hell are you trying to prove?" one said. What I really wanted to say back came to me in a language I had almost forgotten, but had kept logged in my head. Tidbits of surf talk, movie lingo. "This is gnarly, man," I wanted to say. bitching. I hit one of those smokers just at the Point Break, man, and started to drop into the curl, and then I just wiped out, man. I got fried, but I'm ready to get tubular. You know what I mean? I'm stoked. I'm amped, I wanted to say. Instead, I said, got a beer? Sure, one guy said, shoving one in my fist. I fished here last week, I said. Landed two steelies just about out in front of where we're sitting, but I gave it up, decided to take up surfing again. You are completely nuts, a guy said, laughing and pounding back a whole beer at once. Behind him, I could see clouds sliding in, west, maybe a little northwest, and I was sure I could smell something funny in the wind. I watched a few waves break against the sandbar and thought they were beginning to build, but it was the way the wind smelled that seemed to lift me up and pull me again, stumbling and still half dazed toward the water. They stopped me, of course, throwing what was left of their beers down. Just sit, you ain't gonna ruin any more fishing today, bud, one of them said in my ear. Just sit tight. Besides, you only got a half a board, surfer boy. He held me at arm's length like I was his kid's brother, and I was trying to hit him in the face, only my arms weren't long enough. He was young and strong and drunk. Then suddenly, I felt like some creature from out of those old monster movies who slips up out of the past, an odd, scaly monster stumbling around on the screen who looks so oddly out of place, an ancient creature risen up out of the water in the spray, mystified by the feel of something solid under its feet, lost in the world with no way back. I could smell the beer and the smoke from the fire coming out of his mouth, and at first something in me wanted to fight. I imagined I could hear the Beach Boys belting out a chorus of Don't Back Down, and I felt my head surge with adrenaline. I wanted to flip my class ring over and punch him as hard as I could, but when I looked into his face, I could feel something inside of me tacking down and backing off. I snapped back to being 48 years old again. I was 48 and standing around in a wetsuit with a bunch of hardcore steel hitters. They were guys who had fillet knives and sheaths on their belts, guys who would just as soon eat a piece of raw fish right off their hooks or chew broken glass to let you know that you were in their part of the world. On my way to the car, I could still hear them laughing, kicking the remains of the board toward the fire. To keep it away from their lines, they hollered. I sat in the car and watched the wind die down, the lake going flat as a mirror. I watched all six of them head into the lake together. Then each one took his turn casting toward the horizon, my board smoldering in the ashes. I kept the tape deck low, made it sound like the music was coming from far off, the voices muted. I watched them fish for a couple of hours, running my hands back and forth over the defroster vents, dead silent, no lip syncing, no shouting out the window like I wanted to. Well, I'm not bragging, babe, so don't put me down, but I got the fastest set of wheels in town. Instead, I just hunkered down, stayed quiet, and all the way home, it was I Get Around, humming low and steady, my hand on the 5-speed, hoping for just one patch of highway, just one place to stop dead and burn rubber, leaving my mark on the road. Thank you. Now I think I'll read a few poems. Actually, maybe I'll read this. This is all new stuff, so. I'll just read a few poems out of here. This is called The Coast of Nowhere, Meditations on Rivers, Lakes, and Streams. And I spend almost all my free time in the river. I fish all summer, and I fish all fall, and I fish from starting in February when the ice starts to break up, and then I stop fishing for a little while in December and January, because it's a little, I mean, you gotta be really sick to fish in that stuff. So I don't ice fish, so, and I live on a lake, so there's a couple months of real downtime, but I'm manic about it. I'm really, I'm obsessed with it. And probably what I should have done if I'd had any sense when I was 20 years old is head right to a third world country where there's a lot of bonefish and not very many people. And it's an odd obsession because if you really get bitten by it, if you really get addicted to it, and you start buying equipment and gear, and not many people in the other world really understand this very well, that you spend a lot of money, a lot of time stepping into the river, and you're fully outfitted, and it's loony. And I wrote this manifesto because I didn't want to defend it, because it doesn't need defending. Sometimes it needs to be explained to people that really don't get it. So maybe this explains it, maybe it doesn't. Excuse me, it's called What It Is, a Fly Fishing Manifesto. What it is this. After decades of fishing, you come to realize that you live in a house made entirely of desire. Everything is fishing, a life given over to the obsession to be on the water, a way water has of leaking into every pore, every synapse, every fissure of bone, your marrow gone liquid. At night, you hear the fly line singing, and that's exactly what it is, singing in the living room, the line moving rhythmically past the chairs, curving around the television as if it were a river boulder, the fish holding just under the surface of the tube. The stairs are water, falling water, the runs and pools threaded into the risers, the places where your feet have taken you to dreams for all these years. There is water running in the house, rivers coursing in the copper lines, and the deep well, always a conduit to that other place, the dark place, where fear and longing sit like twin brothers, waiting to slip up into the light, make themselves known, carry their rods to the rivers you dream each night. In the morning, a glass of water surges from the tap, and you drink the very bodies of fish into your own body. You stand in the first light glinting off the river, light which moves and streams through the windows, and your entire body shifts to fit that light, the light moving past you like water. Then the transformation, the movement of light through your eyes and into your veins, and you want to gather up your rods and reels, the vest and flies, leave the house and dissolve away. What it is your body becoming like the rivers you fish, the gravel bars and flats inside your body, each memory of fishing in the rain etched topographically until your heart is one solid piece of river terrain. You dream that your heart has its own desires, that it can call you in, and that when you enter the heart chambers, the map of every river you've ever fished rolls out under your feet, the landscape falling like rain into place. The desire to fish always on your lips, each word marked by the sound of moving water, the river in each fleck of your eyes. What it is to know that the rivers are haunted, that someday your father will be on the river exactly where he said he'd meet you. Your grandfather will be there too, and the dead friends who gave you their desire to fish like a man hands over a chalice to the man he leaves behind. All their graves will be empty. What it is to know the air and the sky, the trees, the smallest places where water rests and eddies, then eventually travels on, how the sky is more mirror than anything else, and that with even more desire you could fish the clouds, the sky moving past greater than any river. What it is to know a way inside, that your mind travels down the line through the fly, past the hook into the water, and back through your feet, entering your head cleaner, wider, the river a thread, a rope, a knotless strand of silk. Back at the house, it is still desire in the rooms, desire rising in your wife and daughter, the way their eyes flash, the retinas moist, wet, a thin film of water between you and what they see in you. What it is to lift them up and take them outside, tell them to lean close to your chest and listen, a heart running to catch up with the cataracts it creates. What it is to know that you die going in, you die going under, and you die on the bottom. Your body stays there, then sifts away. They won't find you. They will search for days, find your rod, your hat maybe, even a piece of the sandwich you didn't finish, a half-empty shot of whiskey in the deep bend you named after your daughter. They will grieve and wait there on the shore for days, weeks, standing in all kinds of weather. And they will leave flowers for you, trinkets, messages written on birch bark. They will call up and down the river, and some of them may see your ghost in the cedars. They will think you have gone for good, that you have taken up residence in a place marked by wild rivers, wild fish, a place only dreamed of. But what it is finally is to know that your heart is water itself, always has been. They will come to that slowly when they wake at night in the house and hear the ghost line humming over their heads and feel something wild and pulsing, surging in their own hearts. And I think I'll just read, I'll read just a couple river ghazals. I need to explain. I don't want to explain ghazals per se, but the book is really predicated on loss. I lost one of my best friends to cancer in 1995, and it really became an exercise in trying to see how deep everything went. Jim Harrison's a really important writer to me. He's an incredibly fine writer and has had a lot to do with my interior as a writer. And he has a poem called Returning to Yesenin. And I took a quote from that, a little epigram. It's the epigram to the ghazals. It goes like this. To step back from this swinging man twisting clockwise is to see how we mine ourselves too deeply. The way down there we can break through the soul's rock into a black underground river that sweeps us away. And I always thought that I'd reached the bottom of my soul, but I hadn't. And I really felt as if I'd gone a long way away and I couldn't find my way back. And I think that's where these poems came from. They're little short, little two-line poems. First one. All night I cruise bottom, my life an ice dream, closed river mouths. At the river, she slipped down out of the air, a woman with skin to be written on. Not beside the river, but in the river, rolling again and again toward deadfall. The river's true heart, a cold spring under my flesh, eyes blue as ice. On the night river, I trade my life for the lips of darkness. Two. Trade work for sleep, trade sleep for hunger, give the hunger back to yourself. The dog buried under the trees rises nightly, carries a dream in her mouth. A day of high clouds, the odor of honeysuckle absorbed through her skin. Dream dog, lick my wounds, take this body with you, both of us drifting the river. At the edge of the river, a soul drops its kindling, builds a small fire. Four. There was a year of snow, dogs attacking the house, silence frozen into muscle. On the maps, the weather raged. Down below, I read the book of her skin. An all-day rain, the kind of rain that turns you shiftless, watching the empty road. Let me love the humidity of her body, the dark storm of her hair. Watching the rain hit the river, eating brook trout, rain in the fire, a life speaks back from the coals. Five. Think of your life as wind through a doorway. Whenever you can, trade the bank for the river, the sky for the bird, your skin for pure light. Fuel your heart with single caresses, glances, the sudden visions of your life gone feral. Go to any place where there are more rivers than roads. Trade your flesh for any moving water. Think of your life as a trigger, death in the target, something blazing inside your chest. And one more serious poem, then I gotta put my, I'm not sure I wanna read yet, but I've been doing some of these things lately. This is from a new book, you can't see this very well. It's called The Last Good Water, which is a takeoff on Hemingway's short story, The Last Good Country, which to me is just a beautiful story about the landscape of northern Michigan that he wrote when he's steaming in Cuba. This is one of my favorite pictures of Hemingway. And Hemingway was not the world's greatest human being. We all know that. Holding a shotgun, bare-chested. This is a little piece of prose about this picture. Hemingway, Havana, 1954. Maybe this is what it looks like when the demons are at the door. This is no one to tangle with, it seems. Notice the arms, the way the light grazes the left bicep, the chest pumped, the way the eyes are looking down and through you. There's just the slightest hint of challenge in his face, a look that begs just one more step forward. Even the room looks like something should be taken apart there, clean and sterile, the light probably from a flash bulb shooting into the upper corner of what looks like a bathroom or the end of a kitchen. He looks like a dangerous man, perhaps a mental patient, who has stolen a gun from his guard and will not sit down. It's as if someone, maybe a critic, had scoffed at a sentence or offered up an opposing view. Then he raised the gun a bit more, a double-barreled Purdy aimed at someone, kneeling perhaps. But we know this is part of the show, don't we? We know his right thumb is flat against the hammers, the ends of the two barrels like two vacant eyes. We know his hand is over the trigger guard instead of hovering a hair away from touching off two blasts at once. The pants tell another part of the story. Just coming in from a walk on a darkening beach and no shirt, the consummate fighter. This is a hard man with a neck like a champion boar. This is someone who has been there and back twice, armed. What we know that he doesn't is that just outside the door, lingering in the air, is the breath of a demon 7 years in the future, a father's ghost hiding in a Ketchum basement, a rendezvous with both barrels waiting to happen. This is a man in a kitchen or a bathroom in a Havana who looks like he's won a prize fight or two, like he's hooked and landed more fish than 10 men could in their lifetimes. And isn't that what this is finally all about, a lifetime? The way a life stretches itself out and flexes, moves into the space and time allotted, then takes over and spills beyond its borders and turns feral. And doesn't it feel so odd that he seems so sure of what he's aiming at? There's a gambler in there somewhere, long shots, bullfights, McComber's wife taking aim, Nick Adams heading into a dark swamp. We know this inner territory better than we know our own. Dissected and parceled out in countless seminars and classes, we've read the literature, heard the conjecture, stories about the boy child who wore dresses, the litany of mistreated women, the code, hero after hero dancing to the same song. But we also know the heart. We know in dreams that fragments of his heart settled each night in Africa, some on the Pilar, others on Kilimanjaro, smaller bits of heart tissue scattered like debris from a plane wreck, settling on ex-wives, sons, books not written, dust in an Idaho basement. Maybe he's bluffing. Maybe he wouldn't pull the trigger. Maybe a second later he would have a grin on his face, offer the gun like any sportsman would offer his finest weapon to a friend, but crawl through the barrels in the photograph, move down inside the actual heart, and you'll see scar tissue, words hanging in the cold air like meat. Look around at the dream stuff he carved on the walls. Take each one not as a symbol, but as something actually seen, recorded, luminous there in the coldest chamber of his heart. Even though you turn away to look back out into the world of the living, you'll still see your own breath. And I think I want to take like the last 10 minutes. All this stuff, and I normally don't do this. I haven't done this in a long, long time. This is real. This to me is real serious kind of stuff. You know, this is the stuff that you. This is the stuff you write. Can you still hear me? This is the stuff you write when you think you got a career, but it just kind of vanishes. You know, it goes away. And that never happened. You never really did have one. And then there's this stuff. These are the dead man poems. This book. There have been two editions of this book printed. They're just little. You know, they're just. There's stuff you probably use for kindling. And they won a couple of competitions, and then they vanished. Nobody ever read them. But I like to read them at readings once in a while just to give you a little relief from all this heavy, depressing stuff. You know, you need a little comic relief. So anyway, these are called the Dead Man Poems. And probably about 15 years ago, I was doing a workshop. And I had to give an introduction to this workshop I was doing. And Most of the people at the workshop were probably women who were in their 40s and had just started writing, and they were really intense and really interested in writing. And so I gave this real intense description of this poetry workshop I was going to teach. And then another woman, a woman came in and gave her description of journalist. She was a journalist, a really fine journalist, and she wrote columns. And she convinced, I had probably 12 of these women in my workshop, she convinced all 12 of them to take her workshop so they could write about birds and make money. They didn't want to write poetry. They wanted to write about birds. So I show up, nobody in my workshop except one guy who I went to college with. who was a nitrous oxide addict. He actually drove around with nitrous oxide in his car. And I said to him, you know, we were both riding together in Alma College. I said, this is ridiculous. You know, me giving you a workshop is loony. We can't do that. So we ended up at the bar for 5 days. And we just wrote poems. And he gave me a poem. He gave me a poem to read. And there was this name in it, Dead Man. And I went back. I'll never forget. I went back to my room. And I had a little computer with me, an Apple IIc, which was the precursor of a laptop, which now is a dinosaur. And I sat down, and all of a sudden, this character literally came into the room and said, "You're not writing any more poems, I'm writing these poems." And I remember that happening, and I was just channeling. You know, I was transcribing what he told me to write, and he had me at gunpoint, practically. So I'll just read you a few of these poems, and you can go home. But the dead man he's like a North American trickster figure. He's like a coyote figure. He can be killed, but he can't die. He can be a man, woman. He can be anything he wants. He's really brilliant, and he's really stupid. And he's not to be trusted, but you would trust him with your life. He's that kind of character. I did a reading years and years ago, and there was a Jungian psychologist in the audience. And she wrote a letter to a friend of mine who was at the reading and said that either I was on the verge of a great breakthrough or a complete mental collapse when she heard these poems. So this is the drug you take when this stuff's too serious. So Dead Man's got to meet this character in my head, John Wayne, who when I grew up was the hero type. I never liked John Wayne much, but he was the consummate hero in my imagination. So John Wayne's got to bump him off like the young gunslinger bumping off the old gunslinger. So the first poem is called Dead Man Meets John Wayne. First, Dead Man tells him his boots suck, that he's a wimp and can't ride. Then Dead Man gets nasty. Dead Man walks up to him, grabs his chest hair, breathes a little smoke into his face, tells him his ghost has been running the neighborhood like a mad dog. And Dead Man stares down into John Wayne's face, turns his eyes into the barrels of 22s and says, "The next time you see these eyes, they'll split you up, let some air out of your chest, and the two holes coming out of your back, that'll be my brand." So he thinks he's real tough, see. He gets married. Dead Man gets married. These are poems that are good for all the psychoanalysts in the crowd, see. The night before the wedding, Dead Man sleeps in his closet. His sleep resembles the texture of rust or the surface of a headstone washed by shadows. In the morning, he sends messages to his bride, decides instead to commit suicide slowly. He sends her the tip of one of his little fingers, that first piece of himself. They're dark. He goes bowling, and he doesn't use a ball, he uses his head. Because he can take his head off. Dead Man goes bowling. He wanders up, staring down what he thinks is a long, thin alley of starlight, then takes off his head, slips three fingers into his eyes and mouth, and there, cradled above the floor, his palms roll his head back and forth a little. On the way down, he feels like there is no such thing as wind, imagines the pins exploding in his throat, how each one opens into a black parachute, drifting toward the surface of a dead planet. Dead Man is president. When Reagan was president, I used to say it was true, but it might be. And I'm not starting that fight. Dead Man is president. There is a new war every day. Dead Man sends everyone, babies, old women, even the half-dead are thrown away. Every day, Dead Man goes to airports to count the bodies. He never eats or sleeps, but lives as though this counting were a form of food. Finally, no one but Dead Man is left. The stacks of bodies blot out the sun. Dead Man loves this kind of darkness, loves to lie down in the canyons formed by the dead, to watch the sky blacken with vultures, their screech becoming the dead man's anthem. Let's see. Three or four more. Hormone Dead Man. At the rest home for boring adults, Dead Man sets up a hormone machine, suctions their testosterone and progesterone into gallon jugs, then sets up a spa for himself, a hot tub boiling with adolescent juices. Dead man soaking himself each day in the sweet wash of love chemicals. After weeks of treatment, dead man feels 16 again. High on hormones, he prowls the wastelands for bodies, dragging burnout teachers screaming to his machine. Months pass. Dead man becomes the Hulk of hormones. His body is one living hormonal tissue. More than a madman, he feels every day like he did when he made love for the first time, that his body is somehow electric, full of surges, his brain full of lightning, the world offering itself for burning. This is called 16 Dead Man. And I tell my students at Interlaken that when I was 16, I went to the doctor and I had a whole bunch of testosterone taken out of me and I put it in a vial and I keep it in the refrigerator and every now and then I drink a little bit and they believe it. They absolutely believe it. So this is called 16 Dead Man. From inside himself, Dead Man watches his organs based in hormonal stew. He knows his girlfriend is sending him signals, knows she dreams of the dead man turned into a Harley or a Triumph without a chain guard, some wild piece of steel ripping through soft fog. At night after a date, dead man listens to himself cooling down, the quiet snap of a piston getting smaller, those tiny filaments in his headlight still glowing, the sound of oil dripping softly into the pan, his throttle still warm from a night of riding. Just three more. This is called Professor Dead Man because I'm not an academic, as you can probably easily tell. I'm barely what I am. I could never do that. This is called Professor Dead Man. Let's see. I once had a graduate class where, and I almost got in a fist fight in this class because none of us were allowed to ask questions because he didn't like to answer questions. He just liked to talk about himself, so. This is called Professor Dead Man. For a while, Dead Man plays it straight, reads the classics, memorizes all of Shakespeare, can call up every allusion and pound, knows the meaning of Eliot's epigrams, can explain, he says, the mystery of poetry. Then he goes insane. He comes to believe that the study of English is a form of terrorism. He stalks the campus with a slang gun, taking pot shots at his colleagues, shoots the correct usage out of their mouths, and gets the guys with PhDs to say, "Them are nice pants." At the English department meeting, they call him in. "I ain't late, is me," he says. They move to censure him, ask for his credentials, tell him to turn in his office copies of The Elements of Style. "It don't matter to me," he says. "Me got a new language at work like this. Everything the dead man say is a new part of speech." For weeks, dead man hunts down vocabulary words, nails them like skins to his office door, gets his students to use one-syllable words, double negatives, dangling participles, begins to assign essays using only sentence fragments, has all of them believing that standard English is like a strange virus able to rot their tongues, and that his PhD is really in pharmacy, and he has the cure. Meeting Dead Man. I'm not the director of the creative writing program anymore. I did it for 13 years, and then I came to my senses. I don't have one neutron of administrative blood in me, because I hate meetings. I've been teaching 30 years, and I've been in 40 years of meetings. I've never been to a meeting yet where anything happened of importance. So this is called Meeting Dead Man. They make a mistake. They make him chairman. And Dead Man uses the rules of order like miniature whips, beats down each question, and flogs the vice chairman into submission. At each meeting, he says, "We will have another meeting, which will in turn have a meeting of its own. We will meet constantly. Our lives will become meetings. We will write memos to each other about the content of all meetings. At the beginning of each meeting, we will chant the word meeting until we reach a consensus. We will form a meeting committee with a subcommittee to discuss meetings." All day, all night, Dead Man meets. He begins to believe that everything in life should be run by meetings. To have a baby, you must have a meeting. There are death meetings, sleep meetings, meetings for divorces, and meetings for appendectomies. Dead man becomes the Billy Graham of meetings. He writes a meeting Bible, gets a meeting network, which broadcasts only meetings. He asks for money to have meetings, and then sets up meetings to have meetings about meeting for money. Finally, he can find no one left to meet with who is not already in a meeting, so he watches videos of meetings, runs them slow, then fast forward, watches himself gavel off heads like golf balls, turns the phrase killer meetings into the gospel. And this last Dead Man poem is, Dead Man is a writer. The ultimate arrogance is that he thinks he can write. Dead Man is a writer. Dead Man treats words like roadkill. Runs them down, stops, rolls backward and forward over and over. After he flattens thousands of words, he thinks he has invented a new language. He writes a book and says, here, read this, it'll kill you. Thank you very much. You're a great audience. Thank you. Now you can go over to Breslin and watch the basketball team. Oh, question, yeah, okay. Make it an easy one, would you?
I used to look at Michigan and wrote a story about that, but it's really true that it's
been drowned in the river.
Have you?
Oh, yeah, that is true. Yeah.
Oh,
it's well, that's a true story. We took her fishing that night, and not all of it's true, but what she wrote, most of what she wrote is true. There's a little fiction in there, but it's true. Okay, no more questions. That's what I do all day, is answer questions. My favorite answer is, I don't know. Thanks for coming. Oh, you have a question? Oh, boy. Yes, she did. I wish she was here. Yeah, this is a high school. We have a comment. These are my two girlfriends from high school. Not at the same time. But. It's very sweet to see them. So drive safely. Thanks for coming.